Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast here on the Blue Wire Pod Network, the Thursday, April 28th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am still the aforementioned Chase Thomas coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. On today's program, JD Pickell, a great CFB follow and content creator and film study guy, played college ball. So knows the game quite well, and his videos on YouTube and everything else is great. So go check that out if you've not already done so. So we talked a lot of Baylor, where he played briefly at, and then where Baylor's going, their season they just had under Dave Aranda, the Big 12, some surprises, so a lot of Texas Tech upside here on our conversation. But very fun to talk with JD about all that. Then, of course, the full ride with Matt Green to talk all things college football. Here on the podcast, we have a very loaded show in terms of big monumental news changing the scope of college football in the not too distant future. And it has to do with the NCAA Transformation Committee and what they're looking at, the recruiting window, transfer portal, NIL, all that kind of stuff, and where we're going with that. Coaches walking away, like Matt Luke, like just a lot of more questions in college football and the future of it here on the podcast. We've also got your two coaches who we think will win the most games from a season ago. A lot of good choices here, but we talked about Sarkisian, Heupel, Beamer, Lance Leopold, Jed Fish, Brian Harsin, Brett Bielema, all that and more on the edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast here on the Blue Wire Pod Network. Don't forget, folks, you can also read me. Oh, yeah, I'm writing a bunch over at sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. Wrote two pieces yesterday on Yellowstone. So I one on Yellowstone and one on the Tennessee baseball team. So, yeah, I'm doing a Yellowstone watch. So I've never watched it. Big Taylor Sheridan guy. I love Mayor Kingstown. That's my jam. Sons of Anarchy, also great. So started with episode one, wrote about that, gonna write about that show every single day. So go check that out on what Chase is watching over there at Sports Renaissance Man. And I also wrote about the Tennessee baseball team dismantling Xavier on Tuesday night. So go check that out if you have not read my gamer, different kind of gamer and insight into the Tennessee baseball program as we get ready for the Auburn weekend. But yeah, that's where I'm at in the writing front. So go subscribe there if you've not already done so. You can also watch us on YouTube. Oh yeah, the Chase Thomas Podcast is on YouTube, youtube.com. Type in the Chase Thomas Podcast. That easy, that simple. Go ahead and take care of that today. And then let's see, what else? Oh, if you are not already, go ahead and subscribe to the Chase Thomas Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you get your podcasts, just so that you never miss a future episode here on the program. But if you're already subscribed and you have not already done so, go ahead and hit that pause button and leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at Chase_Thomas. Like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. All right, Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back here on the full ride on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am joined by fellow University of North Georgia alumni, Matt Green. Matt, back-to-back weeks of solid colored shirts. The sports shirts are out of the building. Like, the spring summer wardrobe is here, and that just means dark colored shirts. That's all I got for you.
I guess so, yeah. I guess when it was cold, all my hoodies are like sports hoodies, essentially, so... Yeah, or the North Georgia one. You know, I change it up a little bit. But yeah, neither one of us are repping North Georgia here in our background. I think we need to...
Well, hold on.
Oh, okay. I see you. So, but yeah, this is the spring attire. Just the plain T-shirt.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I have my University of North Georgia, like, license plate. I have one right here, and then I have my diploma right there, or not diploma, degree. And then do I have? I think I have UNG.
What's
alumni.
The difference? Is diploma or what do
high
you
school is diploma, and then degree is college. You don't get a college diploma.
No, I would have no. called it. I would have called it a diploma.
I thought it. I think it. There's a. There's a reason.
I learned
something
it. Today.
There you go. Matt Green, as much as I would love to just talk all things Tennessee baseball for a little bit, number one, again, just an absolute beatdown of the Xavier Musketeers. I don't know if you caught any of that on Tuesday night, but it was a fun game.
I didn't catch that one.
Yeah, I got Auburn this weekend. Georgia comes in 2 weeks, so I'm excited for that series.
Yeah, Georgia's good this year, right? They're like top 10 or something?
No, they're not top 10, but they're okay.
Or like second in the SEC or so? I thought I saw
nope.
something. Oh, no?
Nope. Arkansas is second in the SEC. Oh, and it's not particularly close, yeah.
I'm not a baseball expert. I just saw some on Twitter. Fake news.
Yeah. No, it's all about those Tennessee Volunteers, as you know. Everything's cool. Where's the ding?
Oh, there it is. There's the... For those of you following along at home... Take a
Everything
shot.
School. Yeah, there's number one. Let's
drink responsibly.
Matt Green. So I wanted to start here on this edition of The Full Ride here on the Chase Thomas Podcast with a lot of great reporting from Ross Dellinger of SI. He's been on the show before, really, really plugged in, and had two big things that came out this past week. But I want to start with the big one, which is he has a piece in SI.com entitled College Power Brokers Poised to Turn NCAA Upside Down. This is all following the longtime NCAA president, Mark Emmert, who will be stepping down up until the summer of 2023. And that's only if they do not name a successor before then, which seems like that is a pretty unlikely thing that this will take that long to refine his successor. But names already thrown around. You saw Greg Sankey's name rumored, and he was like, no, I'm good. I'm just going to keep being the SEC commissioner, where he's got more power and it's just a better gig by and large. But interesting to see who's already been thrown around there. But by and large, I didn't realize his departure kind of sets the tone for where we're going, and like a lot could change pretty rapidly. Like there's already been a lot of change, but this is the good kind of change where we might get some positive guardrails in a lot of the sports. We might get some more organizational structures across college athletics. I'm more optimistic about this change and Emmert going away, the guy who called the Kansas Jayhawks the Kansas City Jayhawks after they won the national title this year. Like,
dude, him, really?
Yeah, like that was one of those. Wow. Just when he was presenting the title to the Jayhawks. Oh, yeah, it was an all-time moment. But not a one-shining moment, if you will. It's Put just... In. Yeah, there you go. Nailed it. I don't know. I think the first two paragraphs really set the tone for, like, hey, folks, if you are a college football fan and you're like, hey, I'm focused on other stuff, it's baseball season, whatever, you need to be paying attention to what happens this summer with the NCAA, the next president, where things are headed, because I think we could see a lot of change really quickly. And this is what Ross wrote in the first two lines. Quote, imagine a college sports world where schools are able to offer each baseball player a full scholarship, or if a football team's on-field coaching staff could exceed 25 people. What if the transfer portal was open to players for just 3 months out of the year? And what if the recruiting calendar featured no evaluation or quiet periods? There is a distinct possibility these ideas could become more than just concept. And this is all coming from the Transformation Committee, which is a group of high-ranking college leaders charged with overhauling and modernizing NCAA governance, is considering revolutionary changes some administrators describe as radical. So... this tells me that's coming. Like, that's coming down the pike, that their goal is to modernize this thing. And they're like, NIL's here, portal's here. We've got to get a handle on all of this, because this is an absolute mess. Like, a new coach every day is like, I don't know what's going on. The portal, NIL, like, it's just chaos in the wild, wild west. Clearly, there is an understanding around all of college athletics. And, like, it's got to the point where I don't think any coach is concerned about being open about it, of just... this is a mess. And I think people were scared early on because they didn't want to scare away potential recruits or anything like that. But now everyone's putting their name to this thing and just like, hey, we have a problem here. We need to fix this ASAP, because this is preposterous. Like, you have 1,300 players who have been in the portal, I think, in the last year in college basketball, or something like that. We were like, what is happening? I, obviously, because I've been someone who said for the last couple of years that, like, the biggest impediment to the health of the sport is not NIL. I think NIL is actually good and fine, and just kind of will not change the Bamas and the Georgias and how the sport's been in our whole life. Like, I think the sport will be fundamentally the same. However, the portal and people just constantly moving, and these coaches having to jump and bend over backwards to keep everyone happy, a fear of losing these guys at any point during the calendar year at times, that just, I think that leads to, like, people like Matt Luke just stepping away from coaching and seeing more coaches be like, man, this is too much. Like, juggling these rosters and trying to keep track of who's going where, who's in the portal, who's out of the portal. If you have a 3-month window and you cut this thing down like that, and you're just like, hey, here's your time. If you don't go in and you don't pick somewhere else new at that time, it's over. Like, and then coaches can move forward with this. I am excited about that portion, but I think at the very least, Matt, it certainly seems like more radical change is coming to college sports sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like the writing is on the wall. To the one point that you just made there, I like the portal is like, you know, I love the idea of having, what, a 3-4 month portal period or something, right? Like a transfer period. They do it, I know, in European soccer. Like, so I think that's a great idea, but I don't think the portal is nearly like the weight on these coaches that just recruiting in general is. I think the recruiting calendar, I think, is the number one thing that's got to be changed. So I think they showed, they said some athletic directors kind of gave some insight on what the transfer committee's concept are. And they gave five things: was eliminating scholarship caps, which kind of applies more to other sports because basketball and football kind of have their set scholarships, but abolishing the limitation on coaches per team, expanding payments from schools directly to athletes. But then what four was reconfiguring the recruiting calendar, and then five, implementing the closed periods for the transfer portal. I think the recruiting calendar, I think, is just, it's everything, because like, these guys are committing, you know, class of 2025 is committing right now to places, you know, and it's like, it just gets sped up more and more and more. And I think that's why you're seeing these schools scramble to hire guys in December. Like, if we could just get control of, like, what the college football specifically, like, obviously you got things to do in all of these sports, but with college football specifically, it's just, you have to get the calendar to be logical. Like, you do the early signing period in July or August, you know, and then the actual signing day after that shouldn't be till March. Like, we see how these NFL and college coaching circles overlap so much. Like, you're going to lose coaches to the NFL, to other schools. Like, instead of making 80% of them liars, like, just move the calendar back a little bit so that they don't have to lie to these players and say, oh, they're going to be here for however long, and then next week they're with the Detroit Lions. You know, it's so, I think the calendar is like the number one thing that I look at, much more than the portal, because the portal, it's like, it is like kind of out of hand with the way, but it's like, what does it really matter if you know a guy's going to transfer in January and in October he just says he's going to transfer? You know, it's like, it doesn't, he might not officially be in the portal yet, but I don't think that's as big of a deal as just like these guys just, you know, the constant work. Like, we were kind of addressing with the Matt Lukes of the world. Like, I think that weighs on a coach way more of just like, oh, I need to be calling this 16-year-old. Like, I need to be calling this 15-year-old. Like, I need to get to know this guy for 4 years, and now I'm at another school. And like, it's just such a hectic process. And I think recruiting just, that has to just take all the time away from these guys, family life and just free time in general. Like, and they don't have to do that in the NFL. So if they can coach in the NFL, they can coach ball. They would rather just do it there where they don't have to worry about the decision-making process of 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds.
Yeah, I don't know, but did they do that list that you poured? Was that in order of like importance to them? I don't remember off the top of my head. Was that?
I don't know if I don't think it was in any kind of order. I think that was just like these are some of the concepts that were included like anonymously.
Mm.
Go ahead.
I don't know. What do you think is the most like? So if you had to rank those, how would you rank them in order? It sounds like you got recruiting number one. Then how would you do it for the 1 through 5?
Well, I don't really know how the coaching limit thing seems weird to me. Like these coaching staffs are already huge and then they have all these analysts. Like that doesn't seem as necessary. Like I'm not really sure who benefits from that other than the absolute top of the top, because you would rather be a quality control coach on Alabama's staff than maybe a defensive backs coach on Tennessee staff. You know, it's so limiting the coaches. And the scholarship, I think, was really applying to, like they said, baseball, they have like 11.7 scholarships to give to teams. So you could essentially have all the players on full scholarships. So that definitely seems like a good idea. So that doesn't necessarily affect college football. So, and the payments directly from schools to players, like, I don't know. I just feel like a certain way about it. Like these guys aren't supposed to be on payroll, right? It's just like they're getting a full ride scholarship. Like that is something. And then if Mellow Mushroom wants to also give them some money for making appearances, like yeah, go for it. You know, like that seems like the term, like the spirit of the rule.
Mm.
So like just everyone's gonna get past this. You know, we've seen what Texas A&M and Texas, these schools are doing, and like Florida, like you're paying into a trust almost, and then it's giving money to the players, right? Like you might only have given $50, but you're giving it to that big into that big pool. So, you know, I'm all for these guys like getting some money and everything, but I feel a certain kind of way when it just becomes like pro sports and these guys are like on a payroll. Like if that's the case, like, now we need to talk salary caps and
but
stuff.
We're already there. Like that's what these collectives are. Like that's salaries. Like these guys are getting salaries. That's where we are. Like that's
for
what
sure
we're doing.
But is that where we want to be? Like
you don't have a choice. Like that's just where we're at. Like you can't go backwards now.
I mean, I don't know. I think you can set some sort of limits on it, right? Like I don't know what to do, you know, and maybe you're right. Maybe you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. There you go. But yeah, you could be right for sure. It's definitely complicated. I don't know. It feels so strange to think like University of Tennessee paying your boy like $5 million.
Hold on. No,
if he's getting it, no, I'm not saying we know that, but I'm just saying hypothetically, he's just legitimately on the payroll receiving a paycheck from the University of Tennessee. Like, that's just a crazy concept to me. I don't know if I'm ready for that in college football, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the future.
But is it any worse than a booster giving you just a bag of cash, like by the locker room or something? Like,
no.
Is that any better? Like, I'm not against it. Like, NIL and people who are worried about, like, the haves will become more of the haves. It's like, what sport have you been watching your entire life? Like, Alabama was going to dominate with or without NIL. Clemson and other programs that invested a lot of money in places where they've always had deep pockets were always going to have an inherent advantage. Like, this is how the sport was always going to be. So it's like, hey, if more kids can make some money while getting a degree, and this also can keep kids in school. So Jay Billis was on the pod this week, and he made a really good point that I hadn't considered, which was that NIL does another thing. So for the folks who are just like, college is supposed to be about academics first, like you're there for an academic experience first and you're a student athlete, his point is that, like, well, then NIL only helps because that entices guys who may go straight to the pros and only do a 1 year of college. They might do more years of school. They might stay in graduate student at some point with this and be a graduate transfer and get multiple degrees because they're able to make money while getting their education. So if you are that person, guess what? NIL is something that will keep kids, because they want to keep getting those checks, going to class and maintaining their eligibility and getting good grades and graduating from school that I hadn't really considered. So we saw that with Oscar Tshiebwe going back to Kentucky. He could have gone to the draft. He takes $2 million in NIL like that's out there. Don't know for sure, but if that's the case, he took $2 million, which is about probably a little bit more than he would have gotten in the first year in his NBA contract as a second rounder. Like, that got a kid in school for another year. Like, he's doing more education. Like, that's the whole goal, is more education. So I think you'll see actually more kids be less inclined to make that jump to the pros because they can make a pretty good amount of money while in school. And also, it's pretty fun to be a star athlete at an SEC school if you're a football player or a basketball player. Like, the perks are pretty good. Like, I talked to a lot of those guys. They were not unhappy about their time in school. So I think if they're able to make money and able to get their education, and we can stop pretending that these are just basic student athletes, that they're not generating an obscene amount of revenue for their universities, then I think that's just better for the sport. And I understand people who are uncomfortable with the paying the players and everything else, but I'm like, there's just too much team money. There's too many competing parts where it's just, you cannot have that much money, the obscene amount of money these kids are generating, and it go to one particular pot that doesn't help them. Like, you can't explain that away.
Well, to be fair, a lot of the money is going back into these absurd facilities,
right,
and a lot of these things that do help the players, you know? So a lot of it does benefit them. Sometimes it might be after they've left school that they put in the new,
yeah,
nice indoor practice facility or something. But it's hard to say they don't get any advantage, you know, from it, you know? So, but no, that's a really good point from Jay Billis. Like, as far as like, to claim the whole student athletes, they're students first, like, well, then you should, you know, put your money where your mouth is, you know? It's like, they then let them get their degrees, let them further their education and all that. So that's definitely a good point. I just wonder, because you talked about the haves and the have-nots. Like, that's the biggest problem we have, really, with college sports, is it's like this pretending of what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is such a difference between the Power Five conference and the Group of Five conference. Like, there's obviously
there's
those
even
handful...
a difference now. Power Two. Like, we have to do this tier where I read a really good piece about, like, the Big Ten and the ACC and the SEC have so much more money and so much more power, and they're so far ahead of the Pac-12 and the ACC now that, like, they're in their own tier. So it's like Power Two and then the Power Three and then the Group of Five. Like, I think they've actually put created a bigger size gulf than I think a lot of folks understand. But like, if you talk to people in the know, it's like the Big Ten and the SEC are just in their own super world now.
No, that makes sense. And with Texas and Oklahoma joining the SEC too, I mean, it's only going to be more so. But I there's just not everyone is making money in college sports. So that's what makes it tough, is you have these, what, 20, 30 programs that are actually making money, and the rest, you know, all the money they make is just going right back into everything, into all the sports, and to pay for everything that they have, you know? So I don't know what it's going to look like when all these guys, when they're truly like just semi-pro sports, like they're already kind of there. But it's the biggest thing I want with the new model of the NCAA is, it's just maybe we can get uniformity across the country. You know, maybe all these conferences, we can agree to whatever building the schedules we can agree to, like the drug testing for, like, just this shouldn't even be a school by school, conference by conference type things. Like, these are sports, like, because certain LSU, you can fail 5-7 drug tests. It's like, well, then, yeah, I would rather go there where I can fail some drug tests and still be eligible. Like, that's an advantage they may have over another school. And so that's just one specific example. But you need some sort of just universal rules about this. And most likely you need a commissioner. And Greg Sankey, like you said, like, why would you want to be the NCAA president when you have such a good gig as the SEC commissioner, or the NCAA commissioner, whatever you want to call it, when you have such a good gig with the SEC. So I don't know. I'm really curious to see, you know, what the future holds, really.
And then you have Jack Swarbrick, who spoke really openly with Pat Forty on SI last week about the Power Five splitting from the rest of FBS in the mid 2030s, where it's going to look completely different in that regard, where it's like they're going to create their own league. And then you're really going to leave the Group of Five and the smaller schools, and maybe even the Big 12 behind with that, and just have their own playoff and all that. But I'm like, we should already be there. Like, that's actually one you're not going to sell me on, of like, oh, this is bad for the sport. I'm like, Cincinnati may have just like screwed everybody else over for the group of five, where it's like it's all fun and games until the group of five finds their way into the playoff, where it's like, no, we're not doing this anymore. This is not a thing. We all know that they cannot run the gauntlet. We don't have to pretend that the Cincinnati's of the world and the Memphises of the world can really compete for a national title. Like, once we get there and we stop pretending that the group of five and their budgets and their staffs and their rosters can run the playoff gauntlet and win a national title year, like at any point under any year, I think the sport's better off. Like, if we actually do, like, I've been pushing for the group of five to get their own league and to break it up into another tier forever. Like, that would be so much better. You can still play them and give them the check payouts, like still do the September games like the FCS schools do. But then group of five, like, they have their own playoff, they have their own tournament, they have their own deal. Like, that's how it's just being honest about where we're at. Like, yeah. They do not live in the same world that Georgia does. Cincinnati and Georgia are in two different universes in terms of what they can do and what they can't. And we just pretend that, like, this parity, like you talked about, it's like parity is not a real thing in college football. It never has been. It never will be. And
no, there's always been the blue bloods. That's kind of right. How the sport has always been built.
And you look at college basketball, too, where it's like, yeah, St. Peter's had a great run. But guess what? St. Peter's can't win a title. They can't win every single game in the tournament. They can go on a great run.
But it was more satisfying that St. Peter's, you could have won a national championship.
No, like, they couldn't
if you
have
won
that.
All your games. But if they won all their games, they could have.
But they weren't.
But how satisfying is it that we made a run and then we lost? They lost to North Carolina. Is that right? And then we lost to North Carolina. Like, that's our season. It's just... It's got to suck to go 12-0 and then people are like, nah, your season's over. Like, that is frustrating.
But that's why you do the group of five playoff. Like, you give them their own thing. Like,
no, I feel you. Feel you. That's why they have to do something like that, because not only pretending that they're also, that Toledo is a Division I football program, you know, it's like, yeah, you are, sure, but you're not, you know? No. And so... That they have to do something with that. And I hope whatever changes come don't come because of Alabama. Like, I feel like it's this Alabama fatigue is like tiger proofing golf courses. You know, it's like you can make the format whatever you want. This current era of Nick Saban and Alabama, it's going to dominate whatever format you put it in. So I feel like we should. Before we just react to everything Alabama's done and we need to expand the playoff and do all this, it's like, this is just an unprecedented, like, level of dominance that, like, we've seen it, like, in ancient history, right? Like, Oklahoma won, like, 47 straight games in, like, the 50s or 60s, right? So, like, we've seen domination like this, but it's like, since it didn't come at the time of a change, like a major change, you know, like the BCS era or the playoff era starting, it's like you just accepted that, oh wow, that was dominance, you know. Well, I guess I don't know how people reacted to Oklahoma's winning streak in 1961 or whenever that was, but like, now you're like, oh well, the playoff, it just makes it unfair for these great schools. It's like, no, these we just saw an unprecedented run of Alabama and Clemson, for that matter. Like, that's not going to be normal. And the playoff didn't make them that good. They just had a great run of success for 5-6 years in a row with Clemson. Like, obviously, Bama's been doing it for longer than that. So in terms of pretending those schools are D1, like the group of five, I also feel like we pretend that college football isn't a regional sport. Like, when we see the Frozen Four and it's Boston and New Hampshire and Michigan and Minnesota – nobody is you know, pounding their fist. Why can't we get some West Coast schools in the Frozen Four? You know, it's like, well, that's just not who cares the most about hockey. So with football, with college football, it's like the South, they care the most. They put the most money towards it. A lot of the most talent comes from this area. You're just not going to be able to put a format together where Southeast schools aren't going to dominate the sport. Like, we just – so I just hope we don't, like, make – too many rules in, like, the new era of trying to, like, legislate parity, because that's impossible. And like you said, the sport has never been that.
Yeah, but hey, all I want ultimately is like 20 years of peace. That's what I want. I want like a contract with an organization where they're like, all right, we've got it all down. You might not agree with everything, but here are the rules and the parameters for like 20 years, just to give our fans a break where it's like they can master it and be comfortable knowing that this is how it's going to be for a while. Like, I just want it to be give me a normal decade. Like, we took that for granted, where you go back through and you're like, before the BCS, and you just look through stuff and it's like college football was roughly the same year over year for so many years. And I don't know. I think that,
like,
would be...
I vaguely remember Nebraska and Michigan, like, tying, whatever you want to call it, splitting national championship, just because I just remember Charles Woodson at Michigan. He was just so exciting. Mm-hmm. I was 8 years old, 1998, with the BCS era started. So it's like 8 years old through like 23 years old, it's the same format the whole way through. Now we're just seeing craziness every couple years.
For sure. But ultimately, I think this is going to put college football and college sports in a better spot than where it was with Mark Emmert. I think at the very least, we'll put like less chaos will ensue year over year. So that's all we can really hope for, because we don't have any power in any of this, Matt, and we just hope for the best. But it seems like there's an opportunity here for things to improve for the better. So you had this idea for the main event here on the Chase Thomas podcast. The full ride on the Chase Thomas podcast, and it's year two coaches who win the most games, outside of the obvious being Josh Heupel. You wanted to talk about the pressure aspect in comparison to the wins, but how do you want to outline this, Matt Green? This is your show.
So so I'm a big second year coach guy. I think you've seen a lot of teams take a huge step in second years of head coach. Like, you saw Kirby Smart take Georgia to the national championship in year two. Nick Saban, Alabama, went undefeated in year two and then lost to Florida in the SEC championship. But also you had several, I think Bob Stoops was year two national champion. Who else am I forgetting? Urban Meyer was year two national champion. I think Nick...
What was Larry Coker?
Larry Coker may have been year one or year two.
Year one? Okay.
Maybe, but Larry Coker also didn't even do anything to that program. He just let the players run the show. But so I feel like you just see a lot of Mark Richt's SEC championship was year two. I think Jim Tressel's national championship was year two. Like, you just see a lot of coaches have a lot of success in year two. And so I'm going down the group of five, or the power five coaches. We have eight power five coaches that are in year two this year. And so I want you to tell me, first, who wins the most games, and who's under the most pressure in 2022. So this list, we got Jed Fish at Arizona, went 1-11 last year. Harsin at Auburn, 6-7. Brett Bielema in Illinois, 5-7. Lance Leopold, Kansas, they went 2-10. Shane Beamer went 7-6. Josh at South Carolina. Josh Heupel, 7-6 at Tennessee. Steve Sarkisian, 5-7 at Texas. And then Clark Lee, 2-10 at Vanderbilt. So just out of this list, who do you think is winning the most games in 2022?
This was tough. The most who I think is going to win the most games. I think who should win the most games is Texas, especially if Quinn Ewers is the legit guy there. You have Isaiah Nayer in there. They have so much talent all across the board that year two with Sark and this scheme in a full offseason, a normal offseason, that, like, I don't see how the answer is not Sark. I think he's number one. Is he your number one?
Yeah, I was going back and forth with Heupel and Sark, just because, I don't know, it's just something about Texas. You know, it's like you just feel like they're going to get in their own way. But
they have an easier path in the Big 12. The Big 12 is down. Iowa State lost everybody. Gary Bohannon just transferred from Baylor. Oklahoma State figures to take a step back. Like, you have the wild card with Adrian Martinez. Texas Tech just changed coaches. Oklahoma changed coaches. Like, the path is there for Texas to break through. Like, I don't see how you can't put Texas there in terms of number one and who should win the most. In terms of pressure for me, though, it's Brian Harsin. I don't think it's particularly close. Like, I think Brian Harsin has to improve. Like, he cannot go 6-6 again. Like, I think he 100% gets fired if he doesn't win anything less than, I think his minimum wins is 8 to keep his job.
So Harsin is definitely the only one of these that's actually on the hot seat, like, right now. But
I don't know if I agree with that.
You don't think he's on the hot seat right now?
No, I'm saying I think Sark is on the hot seat too. Like, oh, well, you have Arch Manning in the fold.
That's what I was going to say. I think the definition of pressure is just, it's very different. I don't think Sarkisian's on the hot seat, but he's under a lot of pressure to at least win nine games. Like, I think at the very least, they have to win nine games. And I kind of feel similar with Josh Heupel. Like, it's, I think things are going so well. I don't feel like Shane Beamer is under any pressure whatsoever. Like, they could step back next year, and it's like, but we still love this guy. You know, he's cool. He's our guy. Fits the culture. But Josh Heupel, like, they need a tangible improvement, and that's kind of where Sarkisian is. Like, Tennessee's got to beat Florida. They got to win, like, a solid, like, eight or nine games, I think.
Have you seen the schedule?
Yeah, I mean, do you think Pittsburgh's going to be that good this year? Like, that's one of the tougher ones.
That's on the road. So you got Pitt on the road. Florida,
LSU,
I think,
on the road.
LSU on the road. You get Bama and Georgia on your calendar, which is never easy. And, I mean, you get Kentucky. Like, I think eight minimum is a fair, but, like, 9-10 is where you're like, I don't know. That's asking a lot. Like, 10 is saying that, like, you win every game outside of Bama and Georgia, and that's a big leap.
They went 7-5 year one, though, right? And then lose the bowl game to go to 7-6. So I think at the very least, they have to go 8-4 because that's just tangible progress. And and not only that, it's just the situation. It's Florida being on a first-year head coach. Like, it feels like they're down a little bit right now. So I think that's why the pressure is a little different. Like, I wouldn't argue that Harsin's clearly under the most pressure because it feels like they want to fire him already. But Sarkisian and Heupel are under a different kind of pressure that, like, we're behind you, but you still need to prove that you're the guy. I think the fan base feels more behind Heupel than they necessarily do Sarkisian, just because Texas is just a hard fan base to win over. Like, they just seem like a hard one to figure out. And so, yeah, those are probably the ones I think are under the most pressure.
Well, I think if Isaiah Neyor does not, it's funny that Texas and Tennessee are side by side here because he obviously deflected to Texas last minute and he, like, balled out in the spring game and he looks like the next Jameson Williams. And it's like, man, if you have Tillman, Neyor, and Hyatt with Hooker in this group, like,
you can't get over that loss. Yeah,
I mean,
really,
I really think
heart.
it's monumental. I don't think people understand that, like, we're now, like, it's either gonna be Brew McCoy or Jalen Robinson. So Robinson was a UCF kid who Heupel had, short slot guy, but we have enough slot guys. So you need someone out wide who can just take the top off over defenses. And it's just, I don't know if it's Brew McCoy, USC former five-star kid who's had some off the field issues, but it's one of the two most likely is going to join this receiver room because it's pretty young outside of the top of the class. But you put Neyor with Tillman and Hyatt and Hooker in this guy, like, it's just, that's a different kind of stress on defenses. And I think Neyor would have been enough to, like, really make me think that, like, the matchups are just gonna be too problematic for so many teams where it's like it's almost impossible for this team not to win nine games because teams do not have the personnel to stop this with this collection of talent and with a game breaker like Neyor. I'm just so high on Isaiah Neyor that, like, that loss really hurts, and it could be the difference between, like, Tennessee still being in striking distance of Georgia and Bama in the third quarter. Like, that's just how big it is. And I don't know. We'll see, because Tennessee does still have a hole there out wide, outside of getting Tillman back. But losing Peyton and who am I blanking? Velus Jones, I think, is actually going to be a bigger loss than people might expect on the outside. But I don't know. I think Tennessee, if they get 9 or 10 wins, it's like creme de la creme. That's great. I'm expecting 8. But if you get 9, like, I think we'll know early on if they're getting 9 wins. And it's because they have Florida and LSU back to back. So we'll know very early in the season if Tennessee's winning 9 games. But I don't know. I don't think Heupel's under any. I think year 3 is when Heupel gets the hot seat stuff, because I think most Tennessee fans and the administration recognize that we've already moved past the McDonald's stuff and the McDonald's bag and just how bad, and just the sanctions. We still don't know what those are going to be, but, like, the amount of transfers that Heupel had to deal with when he first came on and just the lack of depth all across the board and just how good this team was offensively right away that he bought himself. This year is, like, even if he doesn't get the wins, if the offense is still fun and Nico's still happy and this offense is still humming, then, like, I don't think there's a any pressure that he has to win 9 or 10 or get really get up there. If he gets 8, even if he goes 7-5 again, I think people are happy. Now 6-6, I think you do some side eyes like, uh-oh, then that might be some firings. Maybe like Tim Banks doesn't survive that because that might be because the defense isn't any better. But I don't know. I think Heupel's fine right now. I think people are still pretty excited about him. And I think the offense, there's no path for the offense not to be good again.
No, I definitely agree with that. I think your assessment might be better, but I guess that's kind of what I mean is it's like if you don't show tangible progress, like if they do go 6-6, then I think it's like legitimate, like sky is falling type stuff.
If we go 6-6, that means we had to lose to Kentucky and South Carolina. And yes, I am sky is falling if we lose to both of them this year.
So
if we lose
to one, I think the sky might be falling. And so I think that's why he's under a different type of pressure. Like Carson, mm-hmm. they want to get rid of him. You know, it's like a different type thing. But right now, I feel like Tennessee and South Carolina feel basically the same about their current head coach. Like they feel like they got the guy. They definitely feel sold that they got the right guy right now after year one. But I think Shane Beamer could repeat exactly what he did in year one and South Carolina fans still be good, whereas Tennessee repeats what they did in Heupel's year two, and it's, are we sure he's the right guy? You know, I don't think we're nearly as, he might not be on hot seat year three because this program, you know, they've kind of adjusted their expectations a little bit on how quick the rebuild is going to be. But I think you would start to worry if we see another 7-6 season.
Yeah, for sure. If it's 6-6, like I said, I think that's a... It's also, I need the context of, like, what the losses were, who they were to, how the games went. Like, do we lose a couple games where it's, like, just a botched field goal or just something dumb in a couple big games? Or, like, we lose a dumb game to South Carolina, but we beat Georgia in an upset. Like, I don't know. There's so many different, like, context things that we just don't know until the games happen, but... I mean, what if Hooker falls off a cliff and last year was an aberration and then now teams have a full year tape on what he did in Heupel's offense that they have to go with a freshman, a true freshman in Taven Jackson because you can't put Joe Milton out there for four quarters anymore. Like, I don't know. Like, I think there's just a lot of variables, but at the very least, I think Tennessee fans have, they're all in on Heupel. They're pretty happy. So as long as the offense is still humming and
I think you're right.
And we beat of Go Kentucky ahead. And South Carolina, we're okay.
See, the Kentucky and South Carolina, that's an interesting point because that's why I felt when we were talking about Tennessee a few weeks ago, if they start 5-0, I really feel like the season is a success, like without a doubt, because there would just be so much buzz around the program. And like at Pittsburgh, that's not like an amazing win, but it's a good win.
Mm-hmm.
Florida, like, you know, they shouldn't be that good next year, but it's Tennessee and it's Florida, and that's a huge win. And then at LSU, like, if you actually see them be 5-0 facing Alabama on College Game Day, like, the exposure alone would just be a huge success for Tennessee. Mm-hmm. If they lose to Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, and even South Carolina down the stretch and finished 8-4, I think you had so much positivity for those, like, first 5-6 weeks that it's enough that, like, it would feel like tangible improvement. Like, I think that mm-hmm. it would just go a long way.
I agree. But I think Carson is just, we've talked about this, where you saw the early over-unders for the West, and Auburn's is the lowest right now in the West. And it's like, if that's where we're at, then it's over. And Carson's gone all in on the Boise guys. So, I mean, I just... Everything about where they're at right now tells me this is it. And he's not long for this job and is under the most pressure. And I don't think he's going to get the wins. I think the most interesting is like who gets the most wins. So in terms of this, I think the first name. So Vanderbilt's screwed. Clarkley is not winning more than two games this upcoming year. I think he's just it's just a really, really bad situation for him in Vandy. But I think Lance Leopold still needs more time. Big 12 should be better this year. And I think the Big 12 is actually going to be deeper than it was last year. I like the coaching staff as a whole a lot more, and you throw in Adrian Martinez at Kansas State, and you throw JT at WVU, and suddenly that it's just going to be a deeper yeah. conference. So
Lance Leopold's your boy, man.
I love Lance Leopold. I like I'm a big Lance Leopold guy.
They're not improving on 2-10, you know, thing.
I just don't know where the wins are. It's kind of like it's still going to take some time. Like I just Kansas, man. it's going to take time. And I think he's building it the right way, though, where I think he's not looking at year one, year two. I think he's thinking about bowling in year four. And I think the program is okay with that. And we'll see. But
are those the three worst Power Five programs right here on this list?
Vandy, Kansas, and Arizona.
Are those the three worst Power Five programs in the country? I don't know if
I
you get
what
I think Vanderbilt is, Vanderbilt would, and Kansas are the clear one and two.
Yes. I would say you could sell me on Duke being a worse Power Five job than Arizona.
They had Teddy Bruschi.
They did. People forget they did that too. Who's like a ambassador and all this kind of stuff now. I'm trying to think. Who else are we missing here off the top of my head? I think Duke's in that conversation. I might put Duke in the bottom three. I think it's we
historically, but they've been like
that's just
been
Cutcliffe,
decent,
man.
In the last,
that's just Cutcliffe.
Yeah, however long.
Like Cutcliffe is doing the Lord's work down there, and now he's gone, and we'll see what happens with Mike Elko. But I have my doubts. I would say Indiana's pretty bad. Indiana's a tough
although
one.
Although they're on the uptick, too. They're,
but it's always
going
to be a basketball
less,
school where it's like, I don't
true.
Know if they'll ever get the resources to really, that's really
same
contend.
Same way Arizona, too.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think they're right there. But like, if you look at Arizona's history, like I didn't realize just how bad like Arizona football is over the course of like 70 years where it's just
yeah
a mess all the time. But all that being said, do you know who's going to be under center for the Arizona Wildcats this summer or this fall?
I don't think I do.
He was the starting quarterback at Wazoo this past year. Jacob DeLora. I think that's how you pronounce it. From WVU. So he transferred over, was able to compete right away. I don't know. I think there's a path to Arizona winning several more games this year than they did a year ago. I think he's recruited.
They can win several more and still not make a bowl game.
Yes.
After so going 1-11.
I'm not saying buy the over, like pound the over with the Wildcats and Jed Fish, but I will say I would be shocked if they're not even like 2 to 3, maybe even 4 wins better than they were a season ago, because I think the offense will be a lot better. They've done really well in the portal. I don't know. I could see a kind of surprising uptick because the Pac-12 South, like Arizona State falling off a cliff, certainly helps in this regard. Like that should be a more competitive game. Didn't they get beat like 1-0 by them? Was that a year ago or 2 years ago? I think that was the COVID year where Arizona State blanked them and that was it for Sumlin. But I don't know. I think it is it's going to be interesting. What do you think about Arizona?
I just don't see the path to success for Arizona. I'm too caught up on their history that it's just like this conference is down as it is.
Jaden
like,
Delora,
you're the bottom of this down conference. Like I'm not too high on Arizona. But you know who we haven't talked about at all is Brett Bielema at Illinois. Like they went 5-7 last year, and Bielema, this guy's got a proven track record of like at least being a good coach. Like he inherited like a really good Wisconsin program, and I don't know how much you know credit to really give him. But, like, he was battling at Arkansas. Like, they didn't have a lot of success, but, like, I don't know. They were never a pushover. Like, it never got as bad as it was under Chad Morris. Like, they were at least a respectable team under Bielema. Like, I don't know. I think at Illinois, like, looking at their schedule, like, it's not going to be easy. So, I think the Big Ten West is going to be improved this year. I think with Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota, and Nebraska in there, like those could be four teams that are potentially like ranked for most of the season. You know, like I think that's a quality side of the conference, and then they have Michigan and Michigan State, so it's going to be tough. Or they have Michigan State from the East, and then also they play Virginia at a conference. But I don't know. You see teams lots of times take a big step with the year two head coach. So I wonder if Bielema is kind of one of these that, you know, is a proven good coach. And at a place like Illinois, who knows? You might surprise some people year two.
I don't know. I look at that schedule and I'm just like, the Michigan State games are losses, but like August 27th, I love that Illinois is just now the team that just opens week zero. Like they're the week zero team. And that game last year with Nebraska was a delight. That was a memorable, really fun game between those two. Just incompetence all over the board, but I enjoyed it. I don't know. I think he's a better cultural fit at Illinois than he was in the SEC. I think his style of play will work a lot better there, and I do agree with that. But like, that offense was putrid last year. Like, they've got a long way to go on that side of the ball, especially in the passing game. But I don't know. I think, like you said, what helps Illinois, and you could sell me that Illinois is a better, like, I think the worst Power 5 job that nobody talks about is Maryland. So Maryland has all of these transfers, and they bring in the 5 stars. Loxley already lost a bunch in the portal this past year. They're in the East, where, like, there's no path to Maryland football ever being a winner in the Big Ten. There's no path. Like, they are in, as long as these standings and they're not in the pod system, Maryland is screwed. Like, if you're, like, yeah, the discrepancy between the East and the West, where, like, Loxley, I would have told him, like, dude, do not take this job. I understand you're a DMV guy and all this stuff, but, like, the talent's there. I even get it. Like, there's a lot of great talent in the DMV. Doesn't matter, because you are competing with Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan every year.
But they, like, get to be the Oregon of Under Armour.
Guess
that's is nice. That not is that not enough? But also, like, and they just don't fit in the Big Ten.
Yeah,
it's like,
I don't care. Like, just, I'm like, who do I pay to get in the Big Ten West? Who do I pay to get out of this freaking division?
Get them back in the ACC, man. Yeah, like, I hate seeing Maryland in the Big Ten. It's just, it doesn't.
Who do we Atlantic swap out? Coast, who do you trade?
Atlantic Coast. Maryland's right in the heart of the Atlantic Coast. You kidding me?
And Duke Maryland was so good in basketball, for sure. Like, you won't sell me on that. But the thing is, like we talked about at the beginning, the Big Ten just makes so much more money and is so far ahead of the ACC that Maryland, I guarantee you, is in a much better financial position than they were in the ACC.
No, I think that's what theirs was all about too. But the switch you would make, obviously, just hypothetically, would be Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh could merge right in there to the Big Ten. You know, they're further
Pat
west than
being a Big Ten guy.
Yeah, they're further west than Penn State is, right? So
yeah,
they
like
fit
that
more in there. So that's what I would do. Maryland just needs to be back in the ACC, like, just for the basketball purposes. Like, they have, like, a solid history in basketball. Now you just see a Maryland Rutgers Big Ten game. You're like, what is this nonsense? Get off my lawn.
And then Notre Dame in the ACC and basketball and baseball, but like
if you map out,
yeah,
if you map out, like, where all the Big Ten schools are, like, Notre Dame could not be more right in the middle of all of those schools. Like, they're so obviously a Big Ten school, but they're playing in the Atlantic Coast Conference for some reason, because geography doesn't matter to these colleges.
Like, West Virginia is a Big 12 school. Like, what are we doing? Like, they're just their schedule sucks every year. I feel bad for those kids. Like, can you imagine being a WVU student athlete and just having to do? And then when they add
UCF,
you're
not going to a road game.
Oh my God, no! Like,
you can play Cincinnati now. I guess you got a fairly close team, right?
Nobody's close, though.
That's an old school Big East matchup, right? Cincinnati, West Virginia.
I mean, I guess, yeah.
maybe for like a tiny period they overlap.
The Bob Huggins Bowl.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. But yeah, so. I don't know. It's we threw geography out, you know, years ago. As soon as Missouri joined the Southeastern Conference, I think it was kind of the Eastern Division of the Southeastern Conference. I think we threw that out.
Well, anything else on that front with the wins, losses, and the pressure there?
No, that's all I got. We'll see. Someone's going to surprise us year two. I guarantee you that. There's always someone who takes a big step forward.
Who do you think takes the biggest step back in that group? Based on what they did in year one.
I feel like Harsin is the easy answer, honestly. It's a cop-out answer. I don't know. I feel confident about Heupel and Sarkisian. I think, and honestly, the closer we get to the season, like, you're going to hate me. The closer we get to the season, the more and more I'm like, maybe this South Carolina, maybe they're trending in the right direction. I don't know. Maybe Spencer Rattler is, you know, doesn't have that stud backup sitting behind him, looking over his shoulder. Maybe he'll play a little bit more like he did in 2020.
We don't play them until November, the second to last game of the year. It's really weird. We never play South Carolina this late in the year. I love it. It's on the road in Colombia.
We just need to, as long as we can get rid of all of these November cupcakes, man. That's, we didn't mention that when we were talking about all the rule changes. The November cupcakes have to go. So I just, playing an all SEC schedule that final month of the season. I think Georgia, Tennessee late in November, and then South Carolina, Tennessee. Those would be some good ones. Georgia, Tennessee, that's I'm looking forward to that being a November rivalry. Like, I'm going to miss Auburn was always that cold rivalry game for Georgia in November, but just because the SEC East implications, I think it could be like potentially deciding the division lots of years with Georgia, Tennessee playing, you know, early mid-November.
Yeah, if we just get through the Florida game, like, that's the game circled. Like, tickets are already insane for this one, and this is just something that you've already got to preemptively jump on because that's going to decide our season, I think. And just, it would put such a damper on all the excitement if you go down at home to Florida with this iteration of Florida. Like, I cannot undersell just how important the Florida game is. It's the most important game on the calendar this year for Tennessee. But to end it on this, because how else could you end it? South Carolina is not winning more than 5 games. I think we need to just go ahead and like, they're the answer for this. They've got A&M at home. Their last 3 games, all losses. So we're going to end with a bad taste in our mouth, unlike this past year with Beamer. Because if you look, Clemson's going to be better this year. And it's on the road at Clemson. You get Tennessee at home. You go at Florida at the end of the year. So Florida has the full season to get used to things and to get acclimated. And that's enough time for Ant, AR-15, whatever, to have a full year of, like, he might just be completely comfortable and just really ripping teams at that point where he might be the dude. Like, if you had to tell me, like, if I had to bet on who's more likely to be a star this fall, Richardson in Napier's scheme or Spencer Rattler in Marcus Satterfield's scheme, give me Richardson every single time. Like, every single time.
I'm taking Rattler over Richardson.
That's fine. But, like,
I don't understand the obsession with Richardson.
Well, like, I think it's a good fit with what Napier did with QBs at Louisiana. So that's, I think, fair. And I would also trust him. I'm trusting Billy Napier and his offensive strategy over Satterfield. Like, South Carolina's offense was a mess last year. And I understand the quarterback situation was a problem, but, like, dude, they had no excuse for it being that bad for the majority of the year.
I don't know. The quarterback situation is a pretty good excuse for, like, having to play a grad assistant at quarterback. Like,
hey, Seb Nolan. But you got Arkansas,
like,
on the road.
Yeah, you got, just start with Arkansas and Georgia weeks 2 and 3.
You're 1-2 there right away.
Yeah, without a doubt. This schedule,
Kentucky
is
on the road,
brutal. Yeah, and then it. Getting A&M in Arkansas from the West is not brutal. Is not a good good pull this year. And then, yeah, like you said, at Florida, Tennessee, and at Clemson to finish the season, they're going to be in this weird position. Like
get them out of here.
How Auburn always was every year. It's like Tennessee was always in the position that they know if they're having a good season or not, like 5-6 weeks in. It's like you play Florida like week 3 and then Georgia week 5 or something. Mm-hmm. You know if it's a good season or not. Like, Auburn has to wait to the end of the year to play Georgia, or always had to wait to the end of the year to play Georgia and Alabama. Like, South Carolina, they're going to have no idea, because you can lose to Arkansas and Georgia. Like, you're not supposed to beat those teams, and then, you know, come back and beat Charlotte, South Carolina State, and maybe they do beat Kentucky, right? Like, and they're 4-2, and then they're just, A&M isn't an easy one. Like, Missouri isn't easy. They got Vanderbilt, but they're going to be sitting at, like, a 5-3 or so. Am I doing 5-4? On the probably going to those last 3 games, and that's just going to be like a total, like,
yeah, 5-4 going into those last 3.
Yeah, and it's like, it could easily be 5-7. Like, so yeah, that's probably the best answer. Like, I like where South Carolina's going, and I feel like Rattler's got them better, but that's a brutal, like, that's one of the tougher schedules you'll see in the SEC East that doesn't include Alabama. Like, that's a pretty tough one.
Get them out of here. Get them out. I'm going to get kicked out of Columbia. Like, I'm just going to be absolutely the most obnoxious volunteer in Columbia. Like, the Sports Renaissance woman's going to have to, like, duct tape my mouth when I'm walking around pregame and stuff. I can't do it. The South Carolina fans have been out of control this offseason. And, like, look, I love you guys. Appreciate you listening to this very podcast, but can't do it. I can't. And it's all the media's fault. The co-coach of the year ended it for me after just burying you in the midway through the first quarter. Like, let's just move on from that.
What were South Carolina fans thinking watching the Georgia spring game? Like, you remember Shane Beamer was just all in on the tight end. Like, it is the SEC media days and the whole get Oscar Delp, whatever the kind of social media thing they had going.
Is that the West Forsyth kid?
Yeah. He was like the number one two ranked tight end coming in the country, coming out of high school. And Georgia fans are like, oh yeah, he looked great in the spring game. We're really excited about him. He's going to be our fourth tight end this year. And South Carolina is just like, yeah, this guy might be starting for us. That's why we really wanted him. So just another little jab in Shane Beamer in that tight end room.
But the culture, it's so good. It's great to be a Gamecock.
Hey man, he took that mayonnaise bath. So everyone loves him for it. He's got a great smile. I think everyone just loves Frank Beamer too. Like in the media industry, I think Frank Beamer is just kind of known to be like one of the nicest people out there. So I think it's some.
Well,
of
I think
that
Shane
too,
is too. But people like Shane. I don't know Shane personally. I don't have a problem with Shane Beamer. It's not his fault that he got buried by Josh Heupel in year one. Like, I'm just saying. Like, it's something personal. None of this is ever personal. But like, it's not there. And like, can we see just six straight games of competent offense before we crown him? Can we see Spencer Rattler for a full year? Can we do that?
That's true.
We saw it with Tennessee. We know what we're getting there. Matt Green, you can follow you on Twitter at Matt_W_Green and all of his great college football content there. And next week, new pod. I guess it's on me. I'll figure out the leading story next week. But always a pleasure, my friend.
We can talk about the NFL draft. How many which school had the most draft picks? That seems like a good thing to talk about next week, right?
Hard pass, but thank you for your recommendation, and it will be under further review. Matt Green, always a pleasure, and I will talk to you next week.
Yes.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am now joined by someone who does a really good job putting together some video stuff that, like, you know, I see the question and I'm like, all right, he's got me, because now I want to watch to see what Quinn Ewers is doing. And it's really good. You're really good at the branding and getting that stuff together. And I like your setup. You got some cool helmet situations going on behind you. And yeah, it's cool to have someone who does college football film study that I learn from, that I feel like I always learn something when I check out his videos. It's JD Pickell, who is here this evening. JD, what's going on, man?
Man, I'm doing phenomenal. I appreciate you hyping me up and getting me some good PR there. But in terms of the helmets, man, that is all our production team. So I can't take too much credit for that. They make me look a lot better than I am. But man, I'm fired up to be on with you and talk some ball.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you did, like, we should give the listeners, so for the podcast, for the folks who are not familiar with JD to this point yet, you will be more familiar as the years go on. I can guarantee you that in the college football landscape. But you played at Cornell, and then you transferred to Baylor. Two very, very different schools, I guess, and two different college experiences, right? Like, what were the, based on, I know it's been a little bit, but like, for you, what was the biggest difference going from an Ivy League school to a Big 12, still at the time, Power 5 school? What was the biggest difference?
Yeah, man. Biggest difference would have had to be just, I think, the level of seriousness revolving around football. Like, the Ivy League is awesome. I have nothing bad to say about the Ivy League, but your special treatment stops once you get into school. Like, there's no priority registration. There's no athlete dining hall. There's no athlete dorms. Like, once you're in, it's like, hey, we did our part. You're in. Like, you wouldn't have gotten here without us, and which is very true. And then at Baylor, it's like, hey, if you miss lunch, you're in trouble. But like at Cornell, it's like, hey, practice is over. I hope you get back to the dining hall in time before the dining hall's closed. Like, so it's just, I think that the level of seriousness, and not to say it's a negative thing about Cornell, but in terms of the budgeting and the resources going towards the program at Baylor, like, there's a lot of money going into that program, and so it should be a serious thing. But I have nothing bad to say about either experience. I was fortunate to be able to be a part of the Baylor program for a really short time. I had to actually retire for concussions, so I had a few too many bumps on the noggin. But regardless, man, wouldn't it change a thing. And blessed to be able to have those experiences.
When you were telling folks that you were like, hey, when you're in high school and you're like, I'm still trying to figure out where I'm going to go play college ball at. And you were like, you know what? I think I'm going to go up north. I'm going to be a Cornell Big Red. That's what I'm doing. Where people are like, you're going where? To play football? Like that's what you're doing? Do they have football?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reference you get 9 times out of 10 is
Andy Bernard.
Like The Office.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like The Office. But yeah, my story with recruiting was sort of interesting in the sense that it became pretty clear towards the beginning of my senior summer, I guess it was junior summer, that it wasn't going to be a Power 5 program. It wasn't going to be, you know, an SEC school or anything like that. So I was like, okay, where can I get the most out of my college experience, get the most and still play Division I ball? Because that was, for me, a level I thought I could play at, and it was non-negotiable for me. So I was like, how can I play D1 ball, whether it's a walk-on or whether I'm going to get, you know, an offer somewhere. And so, yeah, I was fortunate to be able to kind of get the best of both worlds in Cornell. And David Archer's done a phenomenal job with that program. And it's fun to put on that sweatshirt every Saturday, man, and watch him go at it.
Who's the number one rival for Cornell? Is it Dartmouth?
You know, so Columbia,
okay.
The only other program in our conference in that same state. So we play for the Empire State Bowl every year, and that's a lot of fun.
Is it a literal thing? Do you get a literal trophy when you win?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Man, we got trophy games with Columbia and then Governor's Cup with Penn. So, like, those two games you could classify as rivals. But, I mean, nobody likes Harvard, Yale, or Princeton. Like, there's no friends in the Ivy League for sure.
Interesting. Very cool.
Yeah,
very
it is
cool.
It's something, man. It's still football and it's a blast, and like the pageantry is different, but I would say the tradition and the rivalries and the things that are just at a base level fun about college football are there across every conference, which is a blast. So yeah, a different taste for sure, but I loved it.
What do they run? What did y'all run a lot at Cornell?
Like offensively?
Yeah. What'd y'all run? What kind of personnel were y'all doing a lot of?
Yeah, we were pretty multiple. We do a lot of 20 personnel. So we'd have two backs in the game and put me at the slot, or we would put me out wide and catch a smoke screen. And then we do a good amount of just like spread, typical inside zone. They've done some more unique stuff recently. They're like the triple option. And so it really is just like a conference where you can be pretty multiple with whatever you want to run. And yeah, it's a blast. It's a lot of fun.
There you go. Mutation. You had to guess that was going to pop up in the Ivy League. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk, and not some Ivy League, on this very podcast, because it's Big 12 country where your bread and butter is now. And like you said, playing at Baylor, have a strong familiarity with the Baylor program. They win the Big 12 this past year on a crazy ending to the Oklahoma State Baylor Big 12 game. And like that had just all kinds of ramifications after that. And just a crazy ending, one of my favorite endings and one of my favorite games of the past year. But it was a complete 180 from what we saw from year one with Dave Aranda, where it was like, oh, he like the Larry Fedora hire. We were like, okay, he's back to Texas. Like he knows offense. Things didn't end well at UNC, but going back to the Big 12, he runs the offense. Aranda runs the defense. It made sense from an outside observer. We were like, okay, I can understand this. This line of thinking here, if you're Baylor, to replace Matt Rhule. And then it doesn't work. And not only does it not work, it really doesn't work, where you're like, oh man, this is like, you cannot do this in back-to-back years. Baylor is not that program where it's like, we're going to give you a long leash to figure this out and just bet on you anymore. It's like, no, we're Baylor now. We can just go find someone better. We have this commitment to excellence now. We believe that we should be at the top of the Big 12 year over year. And he's like, all right, well, let me just go get Jeff Grimes from BYU. Like, he did some awesome stuff with Zach Wilson, and we can figure stuff out there and just drastically change our offense in one offseason. Just completely run a different scheme, different personnel, different type of play style altogether. And it worked. Were you surprised to see just how seamless the transition was from Fedora in year one to what Jeff Grimes did in year two, at Baylor?
I think the biggest surprise was how well it worked and how quickly it worked, because there's two pieces to this. One, there wasn't a whole lot of room to get worse. And so that was the first part. It was like, hey, whatever you throw out there, the offense will likely look a little bit more competent. Mm-hmm. And the second piece was this style of offense they were installing, which is the wide zone. We can definitely get into that if you, you know, want to, as we progress in this episode. But to give it like the 30,000 foot view, it makes the picture for the quarterback easier, and it makes, in a perfect world, second and third down easier from a down and distance perspective. And so it gave Baylor an identity offensively. And so for that reason alone, you're thinking, okay, if they can get it right a couple of places, they're going to be in position to win games as long as that defense shows up. And that was kind of the thing for even the first year. I mean, the defense was great. Like, the defense was really, really solid, even in that two-win season. And so to be able to pair a competent and at times really good offense with an elite defense, I think, is why you saw what you got to see on the field. So to answer your question, definitely something that came together a lot more quickly than people thought, myself included. But the fact that it was improvement, the fact that Dave Aranda turned it around, I think a lot of people were expectant of that.
I wonder too, because like having talked to a lot of college coaches and high school coaches, and just like how insane the 2022 offseason or 2020 offseason was, where like the installs were just not there, not having full camps, not being able to really get acclimated to your players, to the system, to the area, that I wonder, like, Baylor's one of those what ifs to me, where it's like, if you're Larry Fedora, are you like, hey man, like, I didn't get what Jeff Grimes got this offseason. Like, I didn't get to come in, and we didn't get this situation where, I mean, there were still some protocols still in place last summer, but it was not even close to what it was like in 2020. So do you think that, like, if they had given Fedora a full offseason and he got a full walkthrough to really get guys and get the guys he wants in the portal or wherever, that it still could have worked playing that style? Or do you think that they couldn't risk it to, because like, if they risk it and it's still not better, then Aranda and Fedora are gone after 2 years?
So that was my initial reaction, was, whoa, this is not a reliable sample size. There's been COVID. Guy didn't even get a full offseason to install his stuff. The thing that I think is most condemning to me is in that offense, if you go back and look at those box scores, they're throwing it like 40 times a game and not even trying to run the football. Mm-hmm. And they have an offensive line that's kind of makeshift and patched up together. And so for that reason, I was like, okay, there needs to be some different approach offensively, whether it's with Fedora or without Fedora. Whatever's happening right here isn't working. And I credit a lot to Dave Aranda for having the decisiveness to say, nope, this isn't going to work. I don't care about the sample size. We're going to go another direction, because what we're doing here is not the answer. And I think we've seen from a lot of different decisions Aranda's made, from switching Abram Smith to linebacker to running back, and now making, I don't want to say controversial, but a call that a lot of us didn't see coming, with making Blake Shapen the quarterback as opposed to 2021 starter in Gary Bohannon. I think people understand, okay, there is no knee-jerk reaction with Dave Aranda. He's extremely thoughtful. He's extremely calculated. Everything he does has a lot of logic behind it. And so for that reason, I feel a lot more comfortable, especially, I guess, in hindsight, 2020. But I felt comfortable that, okay, if he's making a switch, there's a lot of reasons behind that, not just the offseason.
Were you surprised to see him go Blake and not Gary?
I was. I thought that Gary Bohannon is 12-2 as a starter, done nothing wrong for you in terms of what he does on the football field. I mean, he hasn't had a perfect, you know, track record. He's not, you know, irreplaceable in that sense. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was one of those people where I was like, hey, man, it's Gary's job until something happens. I mean, he led you to a Big 12 title when you had two wins the year before. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, credit to Dave Aranda for having the decisiveness to say, nope, Blake won this job in camp, in spring camp. Gary, you're going to have a chance to go and play next year, because we're announcing this before May 1st. And he would have had every advantage if he had said, hey, competition is going to go into fall. Gary, you know, you and Blake battle it out. We'll decide before game one. And I mean, I think that speaks to his character, that he let a guy like Gary Bohannon know, who's given so much to a program like Baylor. So I was definitely surprised, though, to see that they made that call in the spring. And there must have been a lot happening behind closed doors to give them the confidence to name Blake Shapen the starter.
I mean, it was wild, because that was something you just don't see. Like, Tennessee obviously has to go through that a little bit, and it helps that Hooker and Joe Milton are close. So you're like, all right, they're probably not going anywhere, but you got to keep Taven happy. You got to keep Taven Jackson, who's coming in as a 4-star spring ball guy. Like the Nico stuff is looming everything, but it's like, until he gets there, until you got it, there is so much more to manage as a college football coach than there used to be. And the May 1st deadline is so interesting that a lot of coaches, we have this idea of like, oh, it makes so much more sense to be the coach who just is like, you praise everybody. I think James Franklin went out of his way to just like name every single player, just played extremely well in spring ball, and was just like, I'm keeping everybody. Like, I'm keeping everybody happy, and this is how I'm going to do things. I don't want anybody in the portal. But like you said, Dave Aranda took a different approach. I wonder, do you think that might have some positive things down the line for them, that he did Gary a solid and that will look good for him in the future? Like, that was kind of like him, not to go cynical of like he wanted to lay the groundwork for future benefit the doubt stuff, but it is something where it's like players talk, and this being out there is like, you can trust Dave Aranda because he will be completely honest with you and straightforward about where you're at in the program, where he thinks things are going. And then, like, he's going to do right by you because ultimately that's just the kind of guy he is, right?
I think it has to. And not only players within the program and the portal, but also high school recruits. I mean, if you're going to preach person over player and stand on that, you have to be able to back it up and say, you know, and be able to point to different instances where you've taken the person over the player. And I think this is a perfect example of that, of him, like you said, doing Gary Bohannon a favor and giving him one more year of college football, where it would have been him, you know, benefiting if he had been able to keep it on his roster. Because now Baylor has a redshirt freshman behind a guy like Blake Chapin, who got hurt in his second game of action. So there is definitely a gamble in a sense, to just from a sheer numbers perspective of experience. Like, this was not an advantageous play for Dave Aranda. This was not what they would tell you to do with the coaching textbook 101, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think it has to play well for him. And if anything, I think it just speaks to the authenticity of a guy like Dave Aranda. Like, a lot of college coaches are going to try and sort of play the game and the portal and NIL, and we've seen that already, but I really think it speaks volumes to the character of Dave Aranda. And even if you don't like Baylor, even if you're the mortal enemy of a Texas or a TCU or an Oklahoma, whatever, wherever you fall in that matter, I think you respect Dave Aranda for doing right by a guy like Gary Bohannon.
Do you think Dave Aranda is comfortable at Baylor long term? Is this not necessarily a destination job, but do you think he sees it as a job that he can win and get in the playoff at least a couple times, or just with where the Big 12 is going? Do you think he is comfortable being the Baylor football coach for the foreseeable future?
I think so. I think it's a really good fit. And if it were a destination job, last year would have been the year to make a play somewhere else, right? With USC being open, Florida being open. Looked like Michigan might have been open for a second.
LSU,
I mean, there were so many things that happened to where if you were going to jump ship and take a job that was more attractive, last year would have been the year to do it. And also, if you're Dave Aranda, you're saying, hey, man, I kind of did what I was supposed to do here at Baylor. Like, they won a Big 12 title, something that hadn't happened here, and I want to say it was like 5 or 6 years. I mean, he did everything at Baylor that has been done. So now for him to say, we're going to win a Big 12 title and then improve on that and try and push for a postseason berth and the playoff and things like that, I think he understands that he's a fit at Baylor. And I don't know that his personality fits everywhere else. That's not to say he couldn't go somewhere else and crush it. I mean, I think he could go to any school in the country and be a success. But for him, from a comfortability standpoint, I think Waco fits him really well. And I think he fits Waco really well.
Does the personnel and the returning talent make you believe that this is a team that can win the Big 12 back-to-back years?
It's a phenomenal question. The personnel alone gives me some pause because they lost a lot of production. Like, Abram Smith is gone, who's an all-conference back. Treston Ebner is a big piece of that offense. He's gone. Now you're going with a different starting quarterback. And then that defense, which really carried a lot of the load for them last year, is going to have a lot of new faces on it. And so I trust Dave Aranda. I think as long as Dave Aranda's on the sideline, they're going to have a really good chance and be competitive in every game just from an X's and O standpoint. But it'll be a new crowd for sure. And so that personnel itself, like I said, gives me pause, but I have a hard time believing they're ever out of it with Aranda on the sideline.
I'm excited to see what they're building there and where they're going to go. But it is something to monitor, because I think it's just going to be interesting with a lot of change. And Big 12 is going to look a lot more different this year. But what do you think of Iowa State? So we were talking about losing production, and Baylor loses some, obviously, Abram Smith and company that you talked about. But also, I mean, it is Iowa State is in a really interesting position now. Purdy, Breece Hall, a lot of guys that Matt Campbell could count on to keep this thing humming, because Iowa State and winning in Ames consistently is tough to do. Like, just go through the history of Iowa State football, and it's Matt Campbell has just done the Lord's work up there in Ames, and he is now going to be tested again. Like, this is, they got a southpaw under center this year, more mobile, bigger dude, very different than what Brock Purdy was doing the last couple years in Ames. But do you think Iowa State is going to be like, this is a crazy question to ask, but when I was going through the roster and just going through where they're at right now, I don't think bowl eligibility is like a guarantee this year. Like, this is going to be such an interesting season for me, for Matt Campbell and this Cyclones team, because it's going to be like, if he wins 8 games, it's like, just build the statue. Like, if he does that, like, just build the statue for Matt Campbell and Ames. But I am so curious. I'm not saying this is going to be the case, but I think if they went 4-8, and a lot of people are like, whoa, what happened in Ames this year? It's like, look at the roster, man. Like, look at where they're at. And I could see it. What about you?
I think them not being bowl eligible would definitely surprise me, right? Mm. Like, that would be something that would be out of left field to me, but I think it's a valid point to make. They're replacing so much. And so I'll go on record and say, I think they will make a bowl. I think Ames is a hard place to play. I don't think people like coming to Ames. I think that'll be good in itself for a couple of wins they wouldn't have if they were on the road. But I mean, this is going to be the year where Matt Campbell proves once again that he is a Iowa State guy through and through, and he's going to make his money this year. Because again, just to what I was saying a second ago about Aranda, Matt Campbell, it sounds like, from what we heard, had a chance to take some other jobs and be in a more favorable location, to recruit from, to live at. I mean, there was a lot of things probably on the table for Matt Campbell. And so credit to him for wanting to stay in Ames. But yeah, it's going to be, they're going to have their work cut out for them. I'm excited though, because Iowa State's a program that even within the Big 12 is kind of fun to root for, just because of what they don't have. Like, I don't know how you recruit to a place like Ames, Iowa, truthfully, but they continue to do it. They just land another 4-star quarterback. So yeah, I think they're going to have some OKGs, some our kind of guys in the chamber, but they're all going to be really raw, and a lot of guys that have very dry feet. So they'll get them wet this fall, but I'm excited to watch it. I think they'll make a bowl just based on being in Ames. I think they'll make a bowl with Matt Campbell, but who knows?
And hey, they deserve credit for being the one of the two Iowa schools to actually attempt to be somewhat competitive offensively. Like, that's a cool thing that they try and do, that a certain other school just has no interest in providing their elite defense with any sort of help on the opposite side of the ball.
Yeah, usually good for the under, though, every now and then.
Oh, that is true. That is true. When you look at Sonny Dykes at TCU, when you look at where the Big 12 is, we'll get into Texas in a second, but Where do you see the hierarchy? Do you have different tiers already in your mind where you're like, okay, this is a tier one based on the roster and personnel and the quarterback play that I think they'll have? Or like, do you have different tiers in your mind right now with where certain teams are heading into 2022 in the Big 12?
Man, I don't. I think if I were to have tiers, it's probably a two-team top tier with Oklahoma and Baylor sitting right at the top. Hmm. But we talked about it on our program. There's just so many question marks. Like, everything we thought we knew about the Big 12 has changed in an offseason. I mean, look at Oklahoma. It was a foregone conclusion a year ago. They were going to be playing for a national title. Lincoln Riley leaves, Caleb Williams leaves. Who knows what's going on at Texas? A lot of those chips are riding on Quinn Ewers being able to come through for them. Baylor will now have a new starting quarterback and lose everybody on defense. And Iowa's replacing their whole team. Iowa State's replacing their whole team. So I'm excited. I think it'll be a great year for the Big 12. I think there'll be a lot of cannibalism within the conference. So for that reason, I don't know that it will get the national credit that probably it should when it's all said and done. I think you could very well see a season like last year where you have a two-loss conference champion, and that doesn't bid well for the playoff and doesn't look great nationally. But the game itself, too, is starting to trend more and more towards that Big Ten style of, we're going to play double tight end, we're going to use a fullback, we're going to play tough defense. And so that in itself, I think, competes well nationally, but within the conference, I think they're just going to absolutely kill each other. So it's going to be fun to watch.
Well, we should also mention, like, Texas Tech brings in the longtime Baylor assistant, Texas high school coaching legend, and Joey McGuire. We have no idea what he's going to do. Like, we have no idea how he'll be as a head coach right away in Lubbock. And then you have Sonny Dykes getting the TCU job. That seems like probably the bit easiest bounce back. Like, if I had to guess who of the new coaches has the best bounce back in the Big 12, like, who would I bet on to win more games than the year before? It'd probably be Sonny Dykes at TCU. Like, he's not... It's so interesting that, like, he, to me, was not a sexy hire whatsoever, but it's, like, it's consistent, where TCU is like, this dude knows the area, the offense is going to be good, it's going to put butts in seats, and the floor is significantly higher with Sonny Dykes than if you take a flyer. Like, I wanted Deion Sanders at TCU so bad. Like, that was, like, I want to see him at a Power 5 school now, and I want, like, that would just be the coolest thing to see Deion in the Big 12, but... I don't know. Like, maybe that can happen still down the line. I don't know. But then you throw in the wrinkle of JT Daniels. Like, it's interesting you bring up the multiple tight end sets that a lot of teams are running. In the Big 12, the dirty little secret is it's been a defense league for the last couple of years. Now you get Brent Venables in there for just a little bit because Oklahoma obviously is not going to be in the Big 12 much longer. But Oklahoma State is dominated. And Oklahoma State's just like, we're Utah East. That's what we're going to be. We're just going to have an elite defense. We're going to run the football. We're going to play ugly football. You're not going to like it. And we're going to beat the Blue Bloods that just don't take us seriously enough. And Mike Gundy, all he does is death, taxes, and I'm going to win 10 games every other year. And he's consistent. And this Oklahoma State team was one bad just kind of read on that. Like, if you cut back it, like, we don't have to relitigate what happened in that Baylor last play, but like 9 times out of 10, he scores on that play. And then you're in the playoff. And it's like Oklahoma State got to a playoff game. And that's just bonkers. But Spencer Sanders struggled. And it was just the Mike Gundy offense is not, it's not the Zach Robinson era in Stillwater anymore. But then you have JT Daniels, where Graham Harrell comes in. So now Neil Brown was running like kind of more of that, what you're and they're like, no, we're bringing in Graham Harrell, and we're getting back to Rich Rod era. We're putting butts in seats. This is going to be fun. Neil Brown, I appreciate you trying the Alabama way and ground and pound, but we're going to go get JT Daniels, and we're going to throw the ball all over the place again. That's what people want. They want Pat White. We've seen enough Pat White jerseys in the stands and Steve Slayton and everything else that this is not going to work. So, yeah, Daniel Holgorsen didn't work out, but we need something like that. I don't know. Out of TCU, West Virginia, and Texas Tech, who do you think wins the most games of that three next year?
Dude, this is going to surprise you. And I say this because of having more time close to him at Baylor. Joey McGuire is the real deal. Like, in terms of what you want in a head coach, a guy that's going to handle culture, because the head coaches are handling culture. They're the CEOs. They're going to hire a good staff. They're going to hire coordinators. I hesitate to say it for this season because I think it'll be a longer term, but Texas Tech's going to be legit, man. Like, they already had, I think, maybe it was a week ago, and I think they just got passed up by somebody else, but they had the number one recruiting class in 2023, which you're talking about Texas Tech, a school that hasn't had that in like 30 years. Like, that is unbelievable. It's uncharted territory for Texas Tech being all the way in Lubbock, Texas. So if I had to pick games for this year, like your question asked, I would have a hard time picking against JT Daniels because I think he's so dynamic. I kind of like the fact that West Virginia is going to zag when the entire conference zigs. So I think that could play well for them. And in a lot of ways, too, we've seen year after year, great quarterback play gets you pretty far, regardless of what conference you're in. And I guess that's kind of ironic, seeing as Georgia won the national championship and there's a question
that's
mark
an outlier,
their own fan
though.
Base about who's playing quarterback. But so I guess to answer your question, I'll go on record. I'll say West Virginia wins more games. But in terms of being a power, I would not be shocked in the slightest if Texas Tech wins a Big 12 title in the next 3 to 4 years. Like, I feel I feel that strongly about Joey McGuire.
Well, it's also they brought in the Western Kentucky offensive coordinator, correct?
Zach
McGuire,
yeah,
pull him.
They're going to air it out, too.
Yeah, and that was an immediate where Western Kentucky was like, what if we just bought an entire staff and brought them over for a year? And that's what they did. And they won a bowl game and beat App State, and Bailey Zappi just throws all over the place. Like,
yeah.
And then Texas Tech was like, okay, we'll just do that too. And I like the staff. Like you said, I think that's just one that's going to take a little bit of time before the wins pop up. But I would not be surprised. And then the biggest wild card of all, you bring up quarterback play, it's Adrian Martinez at Kansas State. Like, the five-star pedigree, what he did at Nebraska, he was just he would do the dumb fumble stuff. Like the Illinois game was like the perfect encapsulation of what Adrian Martinez was at Nebraska, where just the boneheaded plays right before the half, and then he'll do the 75-yard touchdown, where it's, oh my God, like he should be a Heisman guy. Like there's no reason that this guy should not be one of the best quarterbacks in the country, but he just, it's not there all the time. But then you throw him in the Chris Klieman system and what Kansas State does, and you're like, I think people need to put Adrian Martinez back on their radar. Like, I could see him being really good at K-State this year. Could you?
Oh, 1,000%. I think you articulated that perfectly. It might have been in Scott Frost's system, maybe too wide open for him. Like, the guy is such a phenomenal athlete. He's amazing with the ball in his hands. Has a really good arm, maybe a little bit inconsistent with decision-making and accuracy, but, like, is a pretty good thrower of the football when it needs to be. And so if they can make this system a little more binary for him and allow him to have more set up throws to where the windows aren't going to be as tight and he can kind of just go off play action and throw it to whoever it is that's downfield. Maybe it's, you know, Malachi Knowles or whoever it is. Mm. I think he has a chance to be really, really good. I mean, especially with how great he is at running the football. That's something they're going to ask him to do a lot at Kansas State. Like, that's quarterback – rushing touchdown capital of the world. I mean, just ask Colin Klein. So I'm excited.
Still the OC, right?
He's got to be in contention for some postseason accolades if they can be competitive on defense, keeping games. I'm really excited to see that marriage because that is more so, like we were talking about, going to be more of the ground and pound side of what the Big 12 is going to look like. And they're that year every single year. I mean, you could look back 5-6 years, the same Kansas State team, just a different guy playing quarterback. So I'm excited for him. I think you hit that on the head, though. He's going to be dynamic in that offense.
The biggest, I guess, young wild card, and we'll end on this with Texas. So you watch the Quinn Ewers tape. You watch the spring game. Hudson Card, they're keeping happy for right now. They want Hudson Card in this quarterback room come the fall. I don't know. What did you see? Do you see enough there where it's like Quinn Ewers is the real deal and that he should be the guy right away? Do you think he's still a year away? Like, where are you at with Quinn Ewers and where he, like, and what kind of fit you think he'll ultimately be going from Ryan Day and what Kevin Wilson ran versus what he'll be running in Sark's game this year?
Yeah, from a scheme perspective, I think he is the right fit. Like, I think he is going to be really good once that whole recipe sort of gets mixed together and put in the oven and goes through a full bake. The thing that I'm worried about for Quinn Ewers is the guy has everybody in the world, even if you don't care about Texas, watching him and watching how he translates and watching every single move he makes. I mean, talk about that throw he made in the spring game to Nayer, and that was like, feels like it was trending. So I worry about if he's not your guy game one, Quinn Ewers is still like 19 years old. What does that do to his psyche? How, I hate to use the word fragile, but how volatile is his confidence if he's not the guy in game one? Because that was the pitch, I'm sure, when he decided to go back to UT, was come here, be the guy, be QB1. We're going to build around you. You're going to play early. You're going to play game one. And so if that doesn't happen, I wonder how he will respond to that. I think Hudson Card's probably there to stay regardless. The word that I heard was he got into McCombs, the business school, which is a big deal, and I'm sure he's happy to be able to be a UT business student. I think that probably keeps him there, at least until he graduates. But, yeah, man, I think the verdict is very much out on what happens if he's not your guy game one. And I'm of the opinion he needs to be the guy game one just to say, hey, we're going to take our lumps with you, Quinn Ewers. We're going to build around you. We're going to just buy into everything that the Quinn Ewers Festival entails. It might be a 40-point loss to Alabama, but we're going to grow with you and we're going to just keep believing in you. You got a long leash. That's what I think needs to happen. But from a fit standpoint, skill set I think is off the charts.
I lied. I have one last thing for you. Just because
I love
I'm
it. I love
guy.
It, man. Let's do it.
Yeah. You did some film study on Nico. Ia Maliava. The only way to say it is you gotta hesitate after the Ia. You've gotta hesitate, and it's not one you can say fast. But he's on the way in Knoxville next year. What have you seen from him that, like, do you see him with more upside? I don't know how much tape you watch of Arch and Malik, but, like, is there a chance that he's the best quarterback in his class and that Tennessee might have the best quarterback prospect since Peyton?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think without a doubt that's the case. I think from his athleticism standpoint, his arm feels more live than Arch's. Now, I'm not a quarterback guru. I don't pretend to know exactly all of the fine intricacies, but just watching both of their tape, I'm like, Man, Nico fits it in some windows. Now, he played at Warren High School, which isn't phenomenal competition. Now, with him transferring to Long Beach Poly, we're going to get to see him play against some of the better schools in that Southern California region. So I'm excited for that. I think you'll learn a lot from his senior tape. But in terms of the skill set and upside, I mean, guy is off the charts. Like, he's going to be a lot of fun to watch at Tennessee. And, I mean, he's going to have my full attention. And undoubtedly the rest of the SECs, as he's going to be the – I mean, you tell me, Chase, is he really the $8 million man? How legit is that with you being closer to it?
I can't answer that. We can never do it. Like, that might, I will say, I don't think that's ever coming out. Like, I don't know
really?
If we'll ever get a full public answer on that one. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I cannot say. So, but you hear something all the time. Like, that's something you'll, I don't know. So that's all I can say is I don't know for sure. But it's also like when people throw that out there, or just like as an insult, or just like a shot at Tennessee, it's like he's posting the, like, he sees the stats. Like, part of it too is that like Heupel has a year of quarterback tape now for these guys, and he can just show what he did at Missouri with Drew Lock. He can show what he did with Dylan Gabriel at UCF. He can show what he did with Hendon Hooker, who he just brought in the middle of the year and was like, all right, 31 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. We're going to have more 75-yard touchdown plays, pass plays, than interceptions for this guy who we thought was just a full-on just run first option. Like, that's all we saw at Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. And then he's just super efficient, and like, this Tennessee team was electric, and we're up on Alabama after the first quarter, put Georgia on the ropes after the first quarter. And it's just, they don't have the personnel yet. Like, they don't have the bodies, they don't have the depth to go four quarters with the big boys, but they will. And like, if you are a top tier quarterback prospect, it's like, yeah, whatever NIL you throw at me is like, Tennessee will have the boosters and have the money to do that. But like, they still want to play in the scheme. It's not like Jim Chaney was in there. Like, Nico is not coming, even if you like it, or whoever it is. Like, you can throw it at Arch or whatever. But like, there is a difference between throwing that NIL money with Jim Chaney there versus what Josh Heupel and Alex Golish and what this team's running. Like, the tape's there. Like, it does not lie that Nico knows if he plays in the scheme, he is going to put up preposterous numbers. Mm-hmm. Taven Jackson knows he's going to put up preposterous numbers if he's the guy before him. Like, the scheme sells itself. It's super simple, and I'm not saying that as a disparaging thing, but it's like it's a lot of like, we're gonna attack your mismatches, we're gonna do a lot of screens, we're gonna do a lot of quick stuff, and our athletes are gonna get put in space, and we're gonna put so much pressure on you, we're gonna snap the ball a bunch of times, deal with it, and we'll see where the chips fall when they may. And that's, if you're a top-tier quarterback, man, that's what you want to do. And I don't think this is going to stop. I don't think Nico is going to be the last big name that Heupel brings in. I think this is going to be a yearly thing because this offense isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, and for people that have an issue with the NIL side of things, it's like, dude, look around. Like, because this number got out, oh, I put out in quotation marks, like, okay, cool, you don't think that someone like Bryce Young made in that stratosphere last year, if we're talking about $2 million being the yearly wage apparently for a guy like Nico. I mean, that's the world we're living in. And if Tennessee can afford to do that, like, that's going to be a chip that you can use now for recruits. That's a big deal. And so, I don't know. I think it's sort of a soft thing to be upset about because that's just the rules now. Like, if you can play within the rules and you're not going to get NCAA violations for it, like, let's go. I mean, if you want to be upset about that, Ole Miss, saddle up. Arkansas, saddle up. Like, you got to get guys on campus. Tell your boosters that care about the program to make it happen. So I think
it's also just not any different than what it was. Like, I think NIL is way less of a issue for college football than the transfer portal. Transfer portal windows is like, when I saw that, like with Emmert going down, and like one of the first things with Ross Dellinger of SI pointing out that it might change is like a 3-month transfer window. And that's it. That changes everything. Like, that would be, I don't think NIL is a groundbreaking like change to the powers that be, like the Bamas, the Georgias, the whoever are still going to dominate the sport they were pre-NIL. But the transfer portal is a totally different thing. Like, if you put a window there and make it easier to keep up with these rosters and for fans to know that, like, here's the free agency period and that's it, and then these guys are on campus for at least 9 months, that changes a lot. Where if they can nail that down, that is far more of an issue of people just not knowing who's where and when a guy might leave, or like, oh, we have to talk publicly in a weird way until May 1st because we're so concerned about what's going to happen here. That is far more of a issue that I think needs to be ironed out before NIL. NIL is great. It's good for the kids, good for the players. Good for everybody involved. Transfer portal, also good. Good idea. But there just has to be guardrails on that, where it's just like, all right, here just give me a window. That's all we want. You can fix a lot of stuff. It's just, here's when you can do it. Here's when you can't. Done. Like, that's it.
Yeah. These are all good ideas. Like, everybody is thinking in the best interest of themselves. And we like to hope it's with the student athletes in mind too. But like, these are all good ideas and trending the right way. We just got to put some, like you said, some guardrails up to make sure that this is actually accomplishing what it's supposed to.
Yeah. JD, how can the good folks keep up with your work across YouTube and everywhere else?
Man, I appreciate it. So at JD Pakel is my Twitter handle. And then we're on YouTube with CFB with JD. So it's a lot of fun we do there with analysis and play breakdowns and all this, that, and the other, man. It's a good time. So feel free to check that out. But subscribe to this for sure. If you haven't already, subscribe to my man Chase.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, man. I appreciate that. JD, we'll have to check back in again soon. You stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate it.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Thank you again to JD and Matt for coming on this edition, the Thursday, April 28th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Thomas Podcast. If you enjoyed JD and Matt on this very program, make sure that you leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you get your podcast. Go check out all the other great shows across the Blue Wire Pod Network, like The Greenlight with Chris Long with the NFL Draft coming up this week. So check that out. Chris Carter, Wide Receiver One, Spinsters, all kinds of great shows across Blue Wire Pod. So go check that out if you've not already done so. Make sure to go ahead and subscribe to us on YouTube so you can watch this program if you would, if you feel so inclined. YouTube.com, Chase Thomas Podcast, that easy, that simple. Go ahead and take care of that today. Let's see, what else? Sports Renaissance Man, of course, that's me, sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com, so you can read all my work. Writing a bunch over there now, so if you could support me and what I'm doing as an independent content creator, especially on the writing front, that would be great. And becoming a subscriber there by typing your email, that would be awesome. Follow me on Twitter at chase_thomas, and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/chasethomaswriter. All right, Uncle Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.